Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
So all of my advocacy is literally from my own lived experience and having to navigate things and question things about myself and educate myself on things that I've gone through in my childhood that contributed to the state of my mental health today as a young adult. And I think that it's really important to talk about, as heavy as it is, because I do not want to see the next generation of children go through half of the things that I had to go through, because half of the time I went through them by myself.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today we are talking once again about Young Minds Matter. As we have previously discovered, the problem of young minds is big enough to occupy an entire event's worth of attention. And so it was that in October of 2021, the Hogg Foundation, in partnership with our great friends, the Prevention Institute, presented Young Minds Matter 2021, its biennial conference focusing on the mental health and well-being of children and youth. The theme for this year's event was healing, justice, and connection for mental well-being. If we could pull that phrase apart a little bit, I want to call attention to those first two words, healing and justice. One of the things that I am most proud of when it comes to our podcast is that we constantly highlight the cause-effect relationship of healing and justice, that you can't have one without the other. And when it comes to youth, there is a tendency to focus on their vulnerability, their at-riskness, their need for healing, but not as much on their power, their agency. They're thirsting for justice. Why is it important to draw attention to this connection, and what possibilities does it open up? Fortunately, we already have one very smart person's take on that. One of our guests for this episode, Dr. Nia West Bay. Here's what she has to say.
And I think I was shocked when I got into national policy work at how little people who are actually impacted by the policies that we're talking about were in the rooms, were consulted, were part of the process. And I think a big part of the reason we've had so many ineffective policies or policies with unintended consequences is because decisions are being made by people who have no real experience with the issues that they're making decisions about. And so I think I've really appreciated the opportunity in my work at CLASP to be able to bring young people like my colleagues on this call into these national policy spaces to have influence, to have their voices be a part of the decision-making process, because I think the only way we're going to get truly transformational and better and different policy than we've had in the past is by centering and leading with the folks who are living the experiences that these policies shape.
We'll return to that in just a minute, but I also wanted to take a look back to a previous conversation that I enjoyed tremendously and that I think still holds relevance today. In 2019, during the previous Young Minds Matter conference, I sat down with Marlon Lezama, a Houston spoken word artist and co-founder of the Iconoclast Artists Program. The conversation was recorded for episode 88, entitled, you guessed it, Young Minds Matter.
Where I'm from, we live in summer. We speak in family tongues about family through neighbors' eyes. Our dialects change through ever-changing barrios, cuadras, calles, y casas ajenas. Where I'm from, La Lechuza, El Diablo, and La Llorona all become curfews, and there is no talk from American birds and bees. Reputations follow you like 14-year-old backpacks on our 14-year-old soldiers. Where I'm from, education is a thought as crazy as equality. Tree branches become a sign of disciplinary actions. Moms are mommies, tias are titis, grandpas are popos, fathers have always been gone. Where I'm from, music is our narrator, moving us like revolution once did. Young developing flowers shaking and stepping to beats they do not understand yet. Perversion is an uncle not allowing you the kids, but is always welcome to home. Where I'm from, the dinner table is time of conferences of who needs to go get a job, who needs to go get some water, or who just needs to go. Sana, sana, culito de ranas, our doctor. Mosquitoes are always ignored, for the immune system of our ancestors is too strong. Where I'm from, neck dirt necklaces tell you when it's time to go in, along with, because you see where I'm from, everyone is Christian and has a Catholic neighbor. Love is what is allowed, or how good a young couple is at sneaking around. Babies make babies and make families close, and my death is even closer. Where I'm from, my grandmother is beautiful. Aunts and uncles are extended parents, and everyone has a right to beat your butt. Boom, toma. Where I'm from is yellow, purple, green, and gold, and it is beautiful.
So why don't you tell our listeners who you are and just give us a sense of your journey and how you wound up performing in front of us.
So my name is Marlon Lizama. I am a poet. I am a writer. I'm an artist. And I'm also a co-founder of an organization called Iconoclast Artists, where we focus on creative writing and social emotional learning. And I have been working with the community for the last 15 years, just working in some sort of level with the community. Finally decided to create an organization that focused on storytelling and creative writing, and we decided to work with underserved schools and at-risk youth and also with youth that are incarcerated.
Poetry is such a wide-ranging art. Tell us about some of the major themes or concerns that find their way into your work.
So the how I use poetry is, in the beginning, it was to tell immigrant stories. It was to basically tell people where I came from and who I was and about my culture and about my family. So it was kind of a perspective of being a historian to my neighborhood and to who we were. And so I guess if I was to choose a theme, it was a very Latinx cultured, you know, theme.
I've included links to the full episode in the show description. And now, turning back to our main theme, on day one of this year's Young Minds Matter, there was a session titled A New Deal for Youth. The featured guests were members of the New Deal for Youth Changemakers, a Washington, D.C.-based organization whose stated mission is to advance radical and interconnected policy ideas that transform current systems and that center racial, gender, and social justice. We were lucky to be able to bring some changemakers to Young Minds Matter to talk specifically about the group's work related to mental health. The panel was moderated by one of our guests, Dr. Naya West-Bay, Director of Youth Policy for CLASP, the Center for Law and Social Policy, also based in Washington, D.C. Joining her for this episode are Darlicia Dublin, Whitney Lee, and Marissa Houdersheld, all with New Deal Changemakers. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so what does that phrase, a new deal for youth, bring to mind for each of you?
For me personally, I feel like it is a space for us to have a sort of social, cultural, emotional rebrand in society. I know like a lot of us thought of a catchphrase as like when we're looking back at like historical policies that did help in the U.S. I think a new deal for youth for us, we really just came together to I guess use our collective consciousness and our collective minds to create something new that has never been seen before in policy.
For me, one of the things that's really important is I kind of always grew up hearing about how much better we were off than previous societies. And I think that's kind of marked by the fact that there's so much more stuff produced now, that it is easier to have all this stuff. And that people, that a lot of previous generations think we are better off, but a lot of consumption, high consumer culture, is not an indicator of nutrition security or health security and health housing stability. And millennials and Generation Z are actually facing rising house costs, education costs, well with stagnant wages, and also with suicide being the second leading cause of death amongst youth. And that we're actually, our generation is worse, whereas previous generations have done better than the generation before them, our generations are worse off than our, you know, previous generation. And so for me, the New Deal for Youth is created by youth and for youth, just as the New Deal was created by workers to enact systemic changes to improve the lives of current and upcoming generations.
For me, I feel the phrase a New Deal for Youth, I feel it's basically asking the youth what our opinion is, basically giving our ideas and also sharing our experiences.
And I think for me, this is a great question because the use of the term a New Deal is not without controversy, because the original New Deal, while it was transformative for a lot of people, particularly and intentionally excluded a lot of the folks that a New Deal for Youth is focusing on now, right? So the original New Deal initially and purposefully left out Black workers, Indigenous workers, women, a bunch of marginalized communities were not able to benefit from those programs. And so for us, we're hearkening back to the scope and the size of the original New Deal program. Like that was a huge, it was a massive investment and really transformative, you know, during the Great Depression. But the fact that we're bringing it forward and talking about young people speaks to all the issues that Marissa and Whitney raised and what Darlicia is talking about in terms of young people's perspective, where our people did not benefit from the original New Deal. It's time for us to get our due, to get our New Deal, and to really see the change that this generation deserves.
The voice you just heard was Nia West Bay, so thank you. So my next question is that there's no shortage of organizations that aim to uplift youth. I mean, how much actual like decision making power youth actually have in those organizations? I'm sure that varies widely. What makes New Deal change makers special, and what goes missing when an organization like yours isn't at the table?
So this is Marissa, pronouns they, them. And I think what makes the New Deal for Youth change makers special is that we started off our initiative with youth-centered policy and youth-centered framework. And I think when you start off with having a specific goal, then it makes everything else that much, not easier, but I guess goals seem a lot more attainable because we already had a vision. We had our mindset. We had policies in mind with youth. We involved youth directly since the beginning. So I feel like that in itself is what makes us special and unique, because what we've seen throughout this past year, past couple of years is, you know, youth have a lot of ideas. We have a lot of passion and drive. And I think what a lot of older folks, they have wisdom, but what us youth have is passion and drive. And I think this space has been so special because we have allowed the space for young folks to actually, you know, open up, share their stories and their narrative.
I'm Whitney Lee, and I agree with Marissa. I've experienced a couple different organizations that worked with youth, and the New Deal for Youth change makers is youth voices are centered, and the kind of more professionals those that work with CLASP are there just more to guide the process, whereas we, the change makers, are making the decisions for what we want. I kind of feel like the same thing as the way the people, the like CLASP is treating us change makers the same as they were kind of treating adults that had degrees on the state, like when I was working with the state transitions team in Utah, on that we're expanding mental health care for transition age youth in Utah. And they, the state transitions team, did work with youth there, but I felt, well, they did value youth voices on the state transitions team in Utah. The youth voices weren't centered.
And I do one addition, Ike, on the your question about what's missing when groups like the New Deal for Youth are not at the table.
Mm-hmm.
This is Nia Westbay, and I know, so when I've been at CLASP for coming up on 6 years now, and I think I was shocked when I got into national policy work at how little people who are actually impacted by the policies that we're talking about were in the rooms, were consulted, were part of the process. And I think a big part of the reason we've had so many ineffective policies or policies with unintended consequences is because decisions are being made by people who have no real experience with the issues that they're making decisions about. And so I think I've really appreciated the opportunity in my work at CLASP to be able to bring young people like my colleagues on this call into these national policy spaces to have influence, to have their voices be a part of the decision-making process, because I think the only way we're going to get truly transformational and better and different policy than we've had in the past is by centering and leading with the folks who are living the experiences that these policies shape.
Hello, I'm Darlicia again, the stars you're talking. What makes a New Deal for Youth special is basically, it's nobody in New Deal for Youth that everybody has a, like, everybody's passion is being tackled, like, rather it's a most, like, mental health, education, environmental policies within the government, everything is being tackled, which makes it special, which kind of like other organizations, they wouldn't expect youth to be so passionate about what's going on, especially with the economy, with the world, because they stereotype us as we're always want to be on social media. So they kind of like, it shocks them that we want to be so involved.
Okay. Thank you, all of you. Dr. Nia Westbay, these next two questions are for you. So a couple of years ago, you wrote a really excellent blog post for the Hogg Foundation. It was titled, Young Minds Matter, Historical and Cultural Trauma. I would like to quote from it and then get your reaction. Quote, I challenge everyone to think about how we can gift all young people with the language to understand their experiences through the lens of historical and cultural trauma. I also challenge us to think about how lessons from the past can help us to interrupt historical and cultural trauma for future generations. So there's a prevalent notion, first of all, that dwelling on past trauma isn't particularly good for people. That's why it's kind of interesting you say gift all young people. So in what, how do you see it, and in what way do you, are you meaning like gifting to them?
So when I hear this question, a few things come to mind. I think about, there's a Dinkra symbol from West Africa that's the Sankofa. And it's a bird that's looking backwards while its body is facing forwards. And the meaning of that symbol is that we cannot move forward without looking back, right? So it's this really powerful idea that we can't progress if we have not dealt with what has come behind us. I think the other thing I think about was, you know, when South Africa ended apartheid in the early 1990s, and they had a huge effort around truth and reconciliation committees, which was sort of the nation's way of really trying to tackle the trauma that had been inflicted with on the indigenous Black people of that country by the apartheid system at the hands of the, you know, of Afrikaners and other European powers. And so I think what's really important in this concept of truth and reconciliation is that you can't have the reconciliation without truth. And so when you put those two concepts together, so much of the way that we operate in the American context isn't about either, is not focused on truth. And to your point, uses words like dwell to talk about the past, as opposed to understanding the critical importance of understanding and reflecting on and being truthful about the past, to being able to move forward together effectively to a different future. So when I talk about that as a gift, I think one of the other things that I talked about on the blog is that when you don't provide young people that context and that historical understanding, then when they see bad things happening in their life or in their community, they're just left in a place to think, oh, well, this must be my fault. There must be something wrong with us. You know, I guess I don't deserve better. It does all these sort of negative things to young people's mental health experience and self-image. When we don't acknowledge that there are very real things that have happened in the past of this nation that have an impact on how people are feeling, living, breathing, experiencing the world today. Even, you know, there's some research that says that that stuff imprints on our genes, right? There's an epigenetic impact of the historical and cultural trauma that we've experienced that we carry with us, right? So I think, to me, we have to have the truth before we can have reconciliation. We have to look back to be able to move forward and to try to move forward without doing those things is to sort of doom ourselves to keep repeating these cycles of trauma and to keep repeating these intergenerational cycles that, you know, it's time to break that pattern. I think the pandemic really brings that to light. Because the, you know, in the context of a global pandemic, we've all experienced a cultural trauma in the last year and a half, almost 2 years now. Everybody in the world has experienced the cultural trauma of the COVID-19 pandemic. What are we gonna do to make sure that the COVID-19 pandemic is not the historical trauma of not only my children, but my children's children and my children's children's children? How are we going to take advantage of this opportunity, this moment where everybody has this common experience, to say that we are going to make the investments and we're going to make the changes and we're going to provide the supports in mental health, recognizing that this has happened, so that we don't carry this damage forward to future generations?
Okay. And so one thing that I'm wondering then is, are there any real world examples of policy making? And as you're answering this question, Nia, you know, feel free to, you know, tell our listeners a little bit more about what your organization does. Real world examples of policy making that are actually informed by this deep historical understanding that you speak of.
Yeah, this is also a great question. So CLASS, we're the Center for Law and Social Policy. We're an anti-poverty policy advocacy organization in Washington, D.C. We've been around for a little bit over 50 years. And we work across a range of issues affecting the lives of folks who are experiencing poverty or who are living in low-income communities. And there are, when you pose this question, I thought of a couple of examples. Not many of them have actually been enacted into law yet, but some of them have been written. The first example that came to mind is there's a bill called the Rise from Trauma Act. And there's a piece of it that's actually included in the Build Back Better Act that was passed in the House and is waiting to be passed in the Senate, that's focused on investments on preventing community violence and trauma. But in the larger Rise from Trauma bill, as it's crafted, there's some language in there in terms of how resources that need to be targeted, that names that the folks who should be receiving the investments are people who are living in a community that has faced acute or long-term exposure to substantial discrimination, historical oppression, intergenerational poverty, civil unrest, a high rate of violence, or drug overdose deaths. And that language is really powerful. It's sort of a new set of definitions under law that are really defining who are the people who have experienced historical and cultural trauma, and how can we target our investments to make sure that they're particularly going to and benefiting those communities. So I think that's probably the best example that I've seen at the federal level. But there are a couple of other examples that I can name, either through administrative policy or at the local level. I think in terms of administrative, well, this was also legislative. In the American Rescue Plan that was passed earlier this year, there were some unprecedented investments in Native communities. And that I think recognize maybe for the first time sort of the unacceptable ways in which the United States government has dealt with tribal nations and tribal governments. And so these unprecedented investments, we actually did some data analysis where we looked at poverty for youth and young adults last year. And for most groups, 2020 was not a good year as far as poverty. Poverty was up across the board, right? But the one group that because of federal investment saw a significant decrease in poverty was American Indians. And so that's sort of a demonstration that when we target our resources to the folks who have historically been most marginalized, we can actually have an impact and make a difference and make a big difference compared to other groups. But it takes that intentionality and that focus on that community. And the last example I'll share at the local level, particularly in the context of some of what's been going on in the last year, there have been some longstanding campaigns to remove police presence from schools. And we're now in a place where there are a bunch of communities around the country where, because of the leadership and advocacy of young people and adult allies, we no longer have police presence in schools, in those school systems. And I think that's an example of policy action that understands the troubled relationship that communities of color and other marginalized folks have had with police over time, and why putting police in an environment that's supposed to be about development, growth, and learning is counterproductive in light of that history. And so I think that's another example where, you know, for folks who maybe haven't had bad experiences with police or in fact have trusting relationships with the police, it can be hard for them to understand why folks would want to remove police from schools. But I think when you flip it on its head and understand that through the lens of historical and cultural trauma, it makes a lot more sense for why people are fighting for and winning these efforts to remove police from school systems. So those are a couple of examples, but I think what I know in A New Deal for Youth, our whole platform is sort of about trauma-informed policymaking. And, you know, we're hopeful that to the extent that our vision within A New Deal for Youth is enacted into law and policy, that we'll really have a strong example of that sort of transformative trauma-responsive policymaking.
Okay, wonderful. And yeah, and just for the listener, policy encompasses more than just the federal or even the state level. You know, there's lots of, you know, very exciting experiments in policy making that start at the local level. And so just to be clear, when the Hawk Foundation talks about wanting to, you know, change policy making, we really do mean at all levels. So I really do appreciate your focus on that, Nia. Our listeners would love to know more about each of you, Marissa, Whitney, and Darlicia, where you all come from and how you came to be involved with Changemakers.
Hi, this is Marissa. I am from Southern California, specifically from the IE, Riverside, recently graduated from UC Riverside. My advocacy journey started in college through student government, and then that transformed to mental health policy. I was with the Collegiate Mental Health Innovation Council at Mental Health America. And then from there, I got connected with CLASP, and now I'm a change maker. Now that I'm saying all of this in one whim, it's actually a lot. And I think I don't really see it because it's just literally just me talking about my life and the things that I've had to navigate and struggle with as a first generation college student, as a child of a first generation mother. So my policy is informed by my lived experience.
I have my background. I'm from Utah. It's historically like Shoshone and Ute and Paiute land. Originally had a background in wildlife education advocacy. I never thought I could pursue a career in it, and but I always was interested in mental health advocacy since my diagnosis of autism at age 12. I mean, and but it was always something that I would do on the side or later once I became like financially established. But then when I, during college, I developed a lot of chronic health problems and had to drop out. And it took a huge toll on my mental health. I survived a suicide attempt because of the shame and stigma of having to be on government welfare, because it was really stigmatized where I come from. And afterwards, I still struggled with a lot of suicidal ideation, but I decided to commit myself to mental health advocacy and disability rights. And it was through there I got connected to the Youth of Utah Advocacy Coalition and the State Transitions Team, which was working with Utah's Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And they were revamping Medicaid, contracted healthcare facilities, and building kind of up a program for transition age youth, ages like 14 to 26. And CLASP was offering technical policy, like assistance, and that is kind of how I came connected with CLASP. And it was through that connection, I became aware of the New Deal for Youth and Change Makers. I really love what CLASP did in my state and wanted to take up the opportunity to be a change maker to improve mental health policies nationwide. And that is kind of how I got to where I am today.
This is Darlice here. Well, I'm from DC. Washington, D.C. I'm in the Youth Action Board for Prince George's County. We basically, for the youth, with Action Board for the youth that with homelessness, that's like kind of like our area. We help, like, we're trying to get it so where the youth don't have to, if they're like, the crisis really bad, we don't have to go through their parents if they're of age. Like if they're 17, we could just have them sign themselves in, you know, shelter. That's what we're working on with the Youth Action Board. So how I came to be a change maker, they sent out this email saying like, if anybody wanna be interested for the New Deal for Youth, we had to like basically sign up and stuff. And I was like, oh, I wanna do it. Cause sometimes I feel like I'm really nervous when it comes to like I always want to do advocacy, but I was always nervous to kind of like speak up because I feel like what I'm saying, like, it's not really, I don't know, I just felt nervous about it. So I just did New Deal for Youth to kind of challenge myself to like speak up more and don't be so afraid of, you know, don't be afraid because my voice is just as good as everybody else's. And it kind of, to network, and I love diversity, so it was kind of, you know, it was interesting.
Okay. Darlice, I'd love to follow up on something you said about, because it seems like you've mentioned it a few times about the value of speaking up and overcoming your nervousness about that. And I was just wondering if, you know, how much time you actually spend kind of just thinking about that and trying to come up with ways around that. Yeah, I'm just curious.
Honestly, I'm still overcoming it because I was so nervous before this podcast. I'm still nervous now, so I'm kind of just going with the flow. So yeah.
Well, you're doing wonderfully, and I can absolutely relate to that, believe it or not. For all, you know, even though I have communication in my job title, you know, actually talking to people is still and remains a real challenge for me sometimes. So thanks for offering that. So my next question is, you know, on this show, we like to get beyond the academic or the theoreticals, as much as nerds like me love that stuff, and ground the conversation in lived experience. So I would love to know more about, you know, the lived experience of mental health that each of you have had.
So this is Whitney speaking. So mental illness has been kind of, I come from a family that deals with mental illness and neurodivergency on both sides. And I started dealing with suicidal ideation and OCD since I was 10 years old. OCD, I kept silent until I was in my 20s because I thought that I was evil and that it was Satan was after me. I grew up in a really religious family because OCD, most people think it's perfectionism, but what it is, it's obsessions are actually by definition are intrusive, unwanted, and persistent thoughts, and they can range on any theme, including things that are of a sexual or violent nature. And compulsions are actions you do to try to rid yourself or calm yourself of those thoughts. And so, you know, it can be germs, it can be like what you see on the TV show Monk, but it can also be other things. And compulsions can be hand washing, but it can also be like religious compulsions, like I slept with scriptures underneath my pillow, or I shake my head a lot to get rid of the thoughts. That I kept quiet on, and it really drove a lot of things. But I also dealt with suicidal ideation, which a lot of it at 10, and started going into counseling. And a lot of this, the suicidal ideation, and I think I dealt with a lot of a kind of emotional abuse, and I kind of think that manifested into OCD. And I learned I was autistic at age 12, and I came to realize that all my anxiety and depression and suicidal ideation was just due to the ableism and lack of acceptance of autistic people face. I also developed PTSD, and both OCD and PTSD, I remained undiagnosed till I was in my 20s. And I wanted to start advocating, and I talk on very things that people don't talk about, because I kind of grew up around this shame of mental illness, and that it was a taboo, especially on my dad's side. My grandparents were institutionalized, and there was a big stigma that my dad's family faced for having both of my grandparents institutionalized for mental illness. And I'm not going to let society take my mouth shut for this, especially since it's an innate part of my life. And so even at an early age, I was always going to be talking about being autistic and dealing with mental health issues, even on some of the more serious aspects, because I didn't feel like it was right to keep my mouth shut for the comfort of others. And however, it wasn't until, as I mentioned earlier, my chronic illness rendered me unable to pursue my goals of wildlife education that I chose to pursue disability rights and mental health advocacy full time. And so that's kind of been the bulk of my experience.
Thank you for sharing, Whitney. And I also want to similarly add on to your experience. Me personally, I only really said this out loud to a couple of people, but like, I feel like I'm at the point in my life where advocacy is my life, and I struggled with suicidal ideation since the age of 13. And for me personally, growing up in a Latinx household, mental health was never talked about. My diagnosis was because of my own advocacy for myself. I was diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder at the age of 21. And I am now also coming to realize that I also have neurodivergency. I think I am autistic, but this is also a self-diagnosis. So all of my advocacy is literally from my own lived experience and having to navigate things and question things about myself and educate myself, things that I've gone through in my childhood that contributed to the state of my mental health today as a young adult. And I think that it's really important to talk about, as heavy as it is, because I do not want to see the next generation of children go through half of the things that I had to go through, because half of the time I went through them by myself and bottled them by myself. And while that in itself taught me how to self-soothe, how to self-regulate, how to literally be my own therapist. I don't want to see that for the next generation of children.
This Dalice here. For me, mental health was kind of looked past in my household, so it was more of just get over it, you'll be okay. So I have really bad anxiety, kind of socially awkward, but that's self-diagnosed socially awkward one. But it was, I don't know, it was kind of, I don't know, I was kind of scared to kind of look into it more, but as I got older, I was just like, I want to know more. And plus, like, one of my parents had really, they had schizophrenia, so it was kind of like, I definitely wanted to see, you know, learn more about it, because that's hereditary, so I want to know, like, if I don't have it, will my child have it, how to deal with it. So, it's like, I'd rather just learn more about it. As I get older, don't look past it, you know, because mental health now is being talked about more than ever. Because you know how, especially in some cultures, they be sweeping under the rug, don't kind of judge you about it. So I feel like now mental health is finally getting the light shine on as it should have been like years ago. So, yeah.
What are each of your goals for your involvement with change makers specifically, and how will you evaluate, you know, how successful or impactful that you're being?
This is Marissa again. I just personally, my goals in my involvement with this next year is to really just continue the same energy that we started with our first year. And me personally, I would like to have more of like a mentorship role on the younger folks. It's something that I really enjoy doing now. And I hope to really just empower and mostly empower the youth voice, very young children, because I think just from my personal experience, I knew a lot more than I thought that I did at a very young age. And this is why I believe children. I do not second guess what they are saying with what they say to me the first time I believe them. And that's what I hope to bring forth to the table for our next year.
I think for my goals, I'd like to kind of continue what we have in expanding kind of mental health policy. I first came into Changemakers, I had an idea, but I was a little surefer of what we were doing. And so now that I have a better grasp of what we're doing is work on getting policy out there, working with trying to reach policymakers and take the kind of visions we've had and forge them into policies, and both on local level and on the, especially the federal level, is that's kind of the group I'm sitting on, is the federal legislative level, and to see some change from there, and at least if not this year on, you know, passing policy changes, at least getting attitudes to change, policymakers' attitudes to change.
This is Marissa again, and I think next step, both personally and professionally, rest. Rest is a radical form of resistance, and I think one of my new favorite words that I learned this year was that I am a trauma hustler, and I think a lot of us BIPOC folks can identify with that. That we don't even realize what we're doing until we have to actually stop. And I think that's why the pandemic, like, personally hit me in the face, because I had to actually stop. And I realized that, like, my whole life, I've just been moving just from trauma. And I hope that more folks out there get the opportunity to rest and breathe and create whatever they want to create. And yeah. That's my goals.
Okay, just to interject quickly, trauma hustle. Yeah, that could be its own episode. Thank you for the inspiration.
No worries.
This is Thalicia. What's next for me? I'm actually trying to persuade my friends into starting youth advocacy because they didn't vote, and it's kind of with the election with Joe Biden, they didn't vote, and it kind of threw me off. So it was just like, they be the main ones complaining about what's going on with the economy. I'm like, you guys didn't vote. So I'm kind of persuading them to do that. Also joining more support groups with that's young parents, like dealing with young parents, because it's hard out here, especially being like a single parent. So just joining one of them support groups, knowing that I'm not alone, and kind of, you know, sharing resources with them too. So yeah, wish me luck on persuading my friends to join youth advocacy or something.
All the luck on that.
And I can close this out. We have a bunch of things planned for a New Deal for Youth as we go into 2022. The first thing I'll say is if all your listeners could please follow us on social media at New Deal, the number 4, Youth. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, and we're on TikTok. So please, whatever medium is your medium, make sure you follow us so you can stay updated and stay in the loop on what's coming. Some of the issues that my colleagues already raised in terms of heading into a congressional election next year, thinking about what opportunities do we have to influence in that process. So there might be a march, there might be a nationwide mural project, there might be all kinds of things happening, briefings for Congress people. But like I said, if you follow us on social media, subscribe on our website, join the movement, then you'll be in the loop on everything that's coming and you could be part of the work too.
Okay. They are New Deal Changemakers, New Deal for Youth Changemakers, Whitney, Marissa, and Darlicia. Along with Dr. Nia Westbay, we really do appreciate you taking the time to visit with us for a second time within the last several weeks. And for those who missed their panel at Young Minds Matter, that content is now available. That's one of the advantages of doing everything virtually. On the Hogg Foundation YouTube page, I will be including a link in the show description for this episode. So please check that out. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
It is hard to envision a true New Deal for Youth that doesn't include empowering youth to participate in public policy. So it's apropos that in 2020, an organization called Young Invincibles was one of the recipients of a Hogg Foundation Policy Fellows grant. Young Invincibles was founded in 2009. And their mission is to create meaningful policy change for young people by young people. For episode 116, we sat down with a few representatives of Young Invincibles to learn more about their work. Here's a listen.
Yeah, I think a particular challenge that comes to mind is imposter syndrome, which impacts confidence, and this really impacts many students and young adults. It's something that we see start to develop in our education careers. And speaking for myself, it's been a very real barrier that I face. It shows up in ways that make me question if I belong in a certain space and if my voice even matters. And I think a lot of young adults feel this way, feel disenfranchised, and struggle to uplift their own voices. But since I started working with Young Invincibles, this has really helped chip away at this imposter syndrome, and it has given me a set of tools to combat and question that mentality. I've learned to write a testimony and share my own stories with our legislators. And I know that there's real power behind storytelling. And it's just a way to raise awareness, empower students, while also giving that human connection to complicated issues. And we at Young Invincibles really believe that powerful stories help drive change.
The voice that you just heard belonged to Rio Gonzalez, Young Invincibles' recently hired policy fellow. The Hogg Policy Fellow grants aim to increase individuals and organizations' capacity to advance mental health policy in Texas, while also increasing the consumer voice in policy development and implementation. I've included links to this episode in the show description, so please check it out. And speaking of links, don't forget that I have also included a link to all of the recorded session videos from the recent Young Minds Matter conference. You'll get to see the New Deal changemakers in their panel, as well as all of the other rich content that was on offer during that virtual event. So don't miss it. And that does it for this episode. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share regarding the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Especially thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Production assistance by Kate Rooney and Anna Harris. As ever, I couldn't do this without the support of my friends and colleagues at the Hogg Foundation. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review, subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. You can find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify, among others. Thanks for joining us.